Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back, and we are continuing through. I believe this is episode number 16 of our Marvel film series, while we're also talking about new movies. And tonight we're discussing Spider-Man Homecoming, the first of the Spider-Man movies from the MCU, and The Holdovers, Alexander Payne's latest movie with Paul Giamatti and a bunch of people you've never heard of before that you're going to hear of a lot now. Good podcast coming up here. Neither one of us gave Spider-Man Homecoming a great review, but I don't think I'm going to be very negative about this movie. I'm just not going to be overly positive about this movie, but I am going to be overly positive about The Holdovers. If you haven't seen The Holdovers, that's what we're going to start with. I always say try to come in around the 30-minute mark, and then you're playing it pretty safe. This is easily my favorite movie of this year. And John and I figured it out right before the podcast. That's why it took us a little bit, among other things. This is my favorite movie since The Father. Since The Father came out in 2020, this is my favorite movie since then. I don't think I like it more than The Father. The Father really had a ridiculous effect on me. But it was nice to put in a rating of 4.5 on a movie, because it's been a long time since I put a rating of 4.5 on a movie that is relatively modern. It seems like all my 4.5s are coming from older movies that I'm going through the Criterion Collection or something like that. This was great. And yeah, I think it is better than Sideways. Michael Carroll says better than Sideways. I actually think Sideways is probably my third favorite prior to this of Alexander Payne's, but that's the regard that I hold Alexander Payne in. Okay. I just need to establish that before we get into this movie. The Descendants came in at number 100. Nebraska was the second movie cut from my top 100. Like, it was literally 102 before this latest list. Sideways is a perfect movie. Election, I think, is a perfect movie. About Schmidt is way too depressing. But the other four, like those other four movies, I absolutely love. The Descendants was going to drop out of my top 100 because of, you know, just seeing all these other movies and everything like that. But Alexander Payne has four movies that would be in my top 200 movies of all time, which is not a list I'm ever going to do, but it would be in my top 200 movies of all time. This just added a fifth. Like, this movie was ridiculous. So I don't want to keep going too long, because I'll let John talk a little bit, and then I know I'm going to take over too much during The Holdover. So you go.
I knew that this movie was being held in very high regards going into it this weekend, and it still managed to surpass all of my expectations for it. I knew that Alexander Payne decided he wanted to make this, like, not just an ode to 70s film, but he wanted to make a 70s film. And you could feel it in every single way, like the way they shot the film, the way there are so many moments where I'm just watching it and I'm like, it's like the zoom out shot, right? Like straight out of The Graduate. And these different moments where it's like Alexander Payne knows exactly what he's doing in this film. He knows exactly how he is creating this film about, the best way to sum it up is just what I said in my review on Letterboxd. Alexander Payne just knows how to demonstrate broken people better than almost anyone out there.
Yeah. He's very good at that. He's very good at the ordinary. He just captures that so well. Every one of his movies is ordinary people going through ordinary situations that he continuously elevates. If you haven't seen anything by him prior to this, or if you're looking for one to see, I mean, the log lines for his movies, Sideways is just two friends go to wine country. Oh. Nebraska is two brothers take their dad to Nebraska because he thinks he won the lottery. And the Descendants is, a woman dies and then her husband and their kids need to figure out what to do with all the estate money. They're all kind of road trip movies without being road trip movies, right? Yeah. Sideways is and Nebraska are road trip movies. But, you know, a lot of the plots for his movies feel like road trippy. They're always on the move. It's an adventure, even though they're not going on an adventure. You know, that is really what The Descendants is. It's an adventure that him and his two daughters go on without ever leaving the state they live in. And The Holdovers felt like that. These characters went on a massive journey. And the furthest they went was Boston. They didn't go all that far, but it was a massive, massive journey. And I know he didn't write this movie. I know he just directed this, which was also the case with Nebraska. With a lot of his earlier movies, he was also directing them. Also writing them. But you can't have somebody else direct this movie and have it work. It needs to be Alexander Payne directing it. And it's just a brilliant decision to have him be the guy. And the writer was David Hemmingson. This is his first film credit.
Really?
This is his first written by film credit. And he's about to be nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah.
So, that's the power of Alexander Payne. This is just an unbelievably powerful movie. And I think you're going to get a lot of nominations out of this movie. Mm-hmm. I think Giamatti, Dominic Sessa, Devin Joy Randolph, we were talking about it last week. There's really no competition for the Best Supporting Actress Oscar this year, but that does not take away from how great she was. And she is going, that would be the one I'd be floored if she didn't win. That is the one Oscar this year I'm super confident in. Supporting actors wide open, actors open, actresses open. But I would be shocked if she does not win Best Supporting Actress. She is phenomenal in this movie, mm-hmm. and there's just nobody even close to her right now.
No. I mean, we were talking about it last week, what the betting odds were on Emily Blunt for mm-hmm. Oppenheimer, where she was in 15 minutes of that movie.
Yep. Yeah, I think it's got to be her, but... You know, this, see, what this movie did to me and why it's so highly ranked for me is because it captured the feel perfectly. You were talking about he wanted to make a 70s movie. You saw at the beginning he was copying a lot of The Graduate with the same song playing as they're walking through this very barren area. You know, they're doing all of this really monotonous stuff. And it's captured as if it's voyeuristic, you know, it's just, but with the cold and the winter and Christmas is coming and the feeling you get, you could smell that movie. You could taste that movie. You could hear everything. Like it was a 5D viewing experience and it made me miss living in the Northeast, which is hard to do because I hate the Northeast. But it really did make me miss living in the Northeast because it's a great place to come of age. I did it. Mm-hmm. You know, I liked that as where I grew up because you get the seasons, you get the bitter cold, you know, and this movie really captures that too of once he finds out he has nowhere to go, he is trapped in there because it's snowing and it's miserable and it's dark at 3:45 in Boston. And that's just how it is. And he's stuck with these two other people who have nowhere to go. It just captured that feel so well. And it's so difficult for movies to do that. And we see so many fail at it. Mm-hmm. And this one, you felt like you were just watching a slice of life.
Yeah. And the fact that, despite the fact that these characters were trapped together, it never felt claustrophobic, which I think is something that a movie like this from a lesser director would happen. Where it feels tight, it feels enclosed, it feels like these people have nowhere to go. But there's just there's so much space between them because of just the animosity these characters have for each other at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And it gets closer, but it never feels claustrophobic because it feels like a warm closer, right? It feels like as everyone gets closer, the weather outside no longer really reflects their emotions towards each other.
I agree. I do agree. He does a great job of revealing things when they need to be revealed as well. We have that party scene where everything is going really well, it seems like, for everyone. And then it starts to go really bad for everyone. And it is handled so perfectly where, you know, earlier on we hear, oh, you guys have chemistry. And then Paul Giamatti's talking to the one teacher and then they turn around and she's making out with somebody else. And it's that feeling of you fool. Why would this work for you? And you haven't worked for anything. You haven't earned anything. And then you get, you know, that was the same scene where you find out about Dominic Sessa's father, sort of, not really, partially. And then, you know, that's where what is her name in the movie? What is her actual character's name? Mary. That's where Mary is losing her mind over the with the music and everything, and they're having to calm her down because she's just losing it over her son and everything. Those moments are so powerful because they're earned, and they work their way up to them. They work their way up to everything. By the time you get to the end of the movie, you say to yourself, how is this going to end? They got back to the school, and now he winks at him, and the movie just keeps going. You feel like, what's going on? And spoilers, sort of. I'm going to try to talk around it a little bit. But when you actually figure out, oh, that's what's going to be the problem. Mm-hmm. You forget that that's going to be a problem because you forget that we're talking about a high schooler and his teacher.
Yeah.
And they're not supposed to leave the premises. And you forget because it feels like everybody went through such growth and everything became so positive. But there's other characters in the movie who have gone through no growth and are still negative, horrible people. And you forget that they're in that movie.
The worst people. Like, you do forget they're in the movie, but then they come back and you are reminded, like, there is no time wasted to remind you these people suck.
Yeah.
And they are terrible. And, like, even the characters that were not technically introduced to until the very end, you realize why you had such a negative taste in your mouth about them beforehand. But when you actually hear them talk, it's infuriating.
Yeah. Yeah, you realize that they were exactly what they were hyped up to be the entire movie. They were hyped up to be one thing, and they were. And you also understand, though, why this is an issue. Because back in 1970, 1971, the mental health situation was not what it is today. You know, everybody was told, oh, well, more people are depressed now than at any other time in American history. Well, yeah, because more people are going to therapy than at any other time in American history. Because you weren't...
We're more aware of it now is what it
You weren't going for something. A lot of people were depressed without being classified as depressed or schizophrenic without being classified as schizophrenic, whatever it was. Nowadays, a lot of people are being diagnosed as whatever it is that they have, which doesn't mean it's more prevalent in today's society. It just means more people are acknowledging it as a thing that they have. Yeah. And so back then it was throw them away, lock the key. Mm-hmm. And the way that that is handled is perfect. And you see the pain and the frustration and everything with our main character of, what is his name? Angus Tully. You see it. And it feels like a huge moment for him because it feels like he's able to put some demons away. Mm-hmm. All for the reality of he's not even 18 years old, so he has no control of his own life to come slamming back into his face.
Yeah, it's just the entire movie, you're brought to this point where he wants to go to Boston. He wants to go to Boston. You're just wondering, why Boston? What's so special about Boston? And there are some things there. Like, again, this goes to the subtlety of like the set design and stuff in this. His dorm room has like Boston Bruins posters in it and stuff. So you're like, okay, he just really likes Boston for some reason. And then when you finally find out why he wanted to go to Boston, it's just so heart-wrenching because it doesn't feel like it's a lie when he says that his dad's dead. Mm-hmm. And then you find out that he's not dead. And it's that moment of, like, it's the, of course we can go to a graveyard.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, that's not what he means.
Yep.
And, like, the entire, like, gravitas of the entire situation just kind of comes crashing down on you. And you want this to be good. And then it's so heartbreaking. That scene in the medical institution is so heartbreaking. It left me absolutely devastated. I mean, I cried several times in this movie, and that was probably the biggest cry there, was like, this is honestly one of the most heart-wrenching things, because I don't know if you, Phil, have had this experience, but like, I have had family members who have been in institutions, and I have family members who have gone through like dementia and everything, and I've seen people I love respond like this, and it's just, it hurts so much.
Yeah, it's so well handled. in this movie as everything is. All of the characters feel authentic, and it feels like this is a situation that has been lived in by the writer and the director. They're not doing it for the sake of shock or the sake of pulling a twist on you or the sake of, you know, oh, you didn't see that coming. It's not what they're doing. They weren't doing that purposefully. It was just, why would Angus tell his teacher the real reason he's going? He's embarrassed by it. He doesn't want it to be known. He wants to keep it quiet. He also knows that he probably shouldn't be going. So he has to play that, you know, like I said, the younger, whatever personality. He doesn't have a choice. And it's really tough because this is a movie where a lot of people get what they want, or at least learn how to get what they want. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't say anybody ends this movie happy. And I feel that that is very much the staple of Alexander Payne and why Alexander Payne to me is one of the greatest directors of all time.
Yeah.
In Nebraska. And, you know, if you haven't seen Nebraska, you know, take it with, you know, whatever. I'm going to say kind of what happens, but the drive down Main Street at the end of that movie, it's an accomplishment for our main character, but we know he's going back to his shitty life in Montana. It doesn't mean anything. The Descendants, which we talked about and did our whole top 100 movies. That was the first episode. First episode was that in Les Mis. At the end of the movie, when they're sitting there watching March of the Penguins and the ice cream, and you realize everything they've done and this whole journey they've gone on, mom's still dead. That's not a spoiler because, hey, the first minute of that movie, she smashes her head into whatever and dies. So, like, that's what these movies are. He is so good at capturing the human spirit. And, you know, that's such a cliche thing to say, but capturing what it means to be human, which is you can overcome the biggest thing in your life, and there's still going to be problems. You're not going to be in this perfect world situation of, oh, everything's great now because I accomplished that one thing. You might be better off, but as George Clooney says at the beginning of the Descendants, fuck paradise. You know, it's that whole feeling of you don't know. You don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. Is it a car accident, a medical diagnosis, a stroke? You have no idea, but you can accomplish something and go through something and learn and become more human and become more empathetic and more sympathetic and just a better person all around. I don't know many directors who can capture that. And I'm talking with the greatest names of all time. You look at like what Scorsese just did with Killers of the Flower Moon. Normally, Scorsese is very in your face. You get the funny characters. They're all over the top. You know, you think Goodfellas. You think The Departed. Killers of the Flower Moon was very subdued, and it was very subtle. You have to be so talented to create subtle and have the big moments still hit. Not everything's going to have a Usual Suspects ending. So how are you going to capture these small moments and make them feel gigantic? And when Paul Giamatti says it was this eye, you look at this eye. How does that feel so damn powerful? It shouldn't, but it does. And that's just great writing and great directing. I honestly believe, and I think this is an original, right? This isn't based on anything.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I think Hemmingsen, well, he's probably going to have to go against Yorgos for Poor Things, but Hemmingsen is in a good spot, man, to win this Oscar.
Yeah, it's a really impressive script. And like you said, it's these little things. It's the moment where, like, Mary finally opens the box, right, and takes out the baby. She's like, that is another moment where I start bawling in the theater. It's so impactful. It's so small. Nothing needs to be said. Mm-hmm. We don't even see a lot from Mary in that scene. We kind of just watch her place, like, take the shoes out and start placing the things in the dresser. And it's so powerful. It's so subtle. I am honestly surprised at how much positive response this movie is getting, because it feels like a movie that should be divisive, and it feels like a movie that might be too subtle for people, but everyone's loving this movie.
Yeah, this is going to be a movie that's going to be nominated for Best Picture, and then you're going to start to get more people coming out saying, really, this movie? Why? What did it do? It's not that good, you know, whatever. That's when you're going to start to get people who wouldn't have watched this come out and watch it. Same thing happened with Banshees of Inisherin last year.
Yeah.
Same thing happened with The Power of the Dog. If The Power of the Dog was just a normal Netflix movie, then the normal people who knew who Jane Campion was would have gone and watched that movie. Huge Benedict Cumberbatch fans would have watched that movie. Instead of everyone who had access to Netflix went and watched that movie.
Yeah.
So it starts to become overrated, air quotes. It's just because more people are going to start to watch it where it's not their kind of thing. The same way I'm sitting down watching Marvel movies, you're not going to get a 4-star out of me unless you really go above and beyond. Whereas today I watched I'm a Fugitive from a Chain Gang, which came out in 1932, and that got a 4-star rating. So it really is just what is your taste? And I think the holdovers right now, it's the people who love Alexander Payne. It's the people who love film. Michael Carroll says, will it get hurt by being classified as a Christmas movie? I don't think it will, because I think that this could go down as the best Christmas movie to come out since Elf. Like, I try to think of another great Christmas movie that's come out since then. This had so much heart and everything, and this is damn right a Christmas movie.
Yeah. It's absolutely a Christmas movie. I look forward to kind of having an excuse to revisit it every couple of years because it's a Christmas movie.
I agree. This will be one now it's easy. My wife didn't see it with me when I went and saw it. It's easy to get her to watch it now because, oh, it's a Christmas movie. Watch it a week before Christmas.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think it perfectly embodies that. Like, it embodies the spirit of Christmas because it focuses so much on the loneliness associated with the holiday, which is something that a lot of people avoid talking about at Christmas time, but a lot of people go through at Christmas time.
Yeah, it's, you know, people never talk about all of that. If you haven't heard Christmas Song by Phoebe Bridgers, you should listen to it because it's freaking hilarious. And it's not hilarious, but it is hilarious because only Phoebe Bridgers would write a sad Christmas song like that. If that's what she's going to do, I can't wait to see Julian Baker's follow-up to it because it'll be even more depressing. But what is it? When sadness comes crashing like a brick through your window, and but it's Christmas and no one can fix it. It's fantastic. Like that's the type of stuff we're talking about. That song pretty much is everything the Holdovers is, where the Holdovers is sadness comes crashing, you know, right through. It's devastating. And you see all these characters being ripped apart. And what I love about it is it has a very Northeast personality of they're telling each other that they don't like them. You smell and it gets worse near the end of the day. Well, you are this type of person. You are this type of person. The way they go at each other and are so honest with each other, but they aren't honest with each other until they feel comfortable being honest with each other. It's not like they're rude people. The only guy who sucks is Koontz or whatever his name is.
He's the worst.
Yeah, he's terrible. Everybody else, they don't start being mean to them until it's almost a, hey, I'm your buddy, so I'm going to tell you what I don't like about you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting because, again, that's one of those things that feels like it should be off-putting about this movie too, right? Like, people get uncomfortable in those situations where people are just very blunt. Mm-hmm. But it feels more human. It just feels more real this way. I mean, I didn't realize that was a Northeastern thing, but...
It's very Northeastern, dude. It's so Northeastern. It's so Northeastern. This movie reminded me a lot of Manchester by the Sea, except this was more accessible to me. This was
not as depressing.
Yeah, this was not as depressing, but this was something I could relate more to.
Yes.
But I always say that the scene in Manchester by the Sea that I think is the seriously like one of the best scenes from the last 20 years. And I thought the movie was good. I didn't think it was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. But one of my favorite scenes in anything I've seen is just when they're looking for the car. Where did you park it? What do you mean, where did I park? And they're freezing their asses off. And they're yelling at each other because they just want to get in this car. And it's so much with the character. And it's so much with the setting. And you can feel their cold. You can feel their annoyance. It's one of the most Northeast scenes ever. Because if you ever go, and I mean, you live on an island, but you're out in Vancouver. So you're a little bit more temperate than the Northeast. Because the Northeast will get into the negatives and stuff like that. So when you're by the water in December or January or February in the Northeast, and the wind is whipping and hitting you, and it's already 10, 11 degrees out, and then you're getting hit with the wind on top of that, it's miserable. And I'm talking Fahrenheit, not Celsius.
Yeah.
Don't worry. But
I know.
it's just so well done. And I feel like that's what the Holdovers did. And it goes, Michael Carroll said the space was another character. It got bigger as folks left the school. Those are the things that I really love in these types of movies. And Manchester by the Sea did space really well. This movie is doing space really, really, really well.
Yeah. And I think part of it comes down to, I really enjoy kind of like the fake out you get in this movie, where it feel where at the first half, it makes you seem to think that this is going to be these like this random group of kids coming together and like bonding over this break. And then they take all of them away except for one. It was just such a moment where it's like, wait, is this actually happening? And the movie's so much better for it, because you needed that. You needed those children there and like the other kids just to put an emphasis on how bad it is when you are the only one there.
Yeah. I wish your parents would have answered the phone so I could have sent you, so I could have had my week.
Yeah.
You know, that's what Giamatti's saying. He doesn't want him there either, but he can't get rid of him. There's nothing he can do. And I love it because it's so much more authentic. Mm-hmm. If you had just immediately gone to, oh, Dominic says is the only one left behind, well, it's going to feel a little forced, a little rushed, not really authentic at all. But the fact that all the other kids are there and he's going through all that and then he gets left behind again, especially when he was not even supposed to be one of the holdovers, it's brutal. It's absolutely devastating. So, yeah, I really hope that Dominic Sessa finds his way into an Oscar nom. I don't know if he's going to be able to fit, man. It is a crowded year. But I hope he can find a way, maybe. He's so good in this movie. Maybe he pulls the – what's his name from – oh my God, After Sun.
Oh, Paul Mescal?
Paul Mescal. Yeah, maybe he pulls that and just shockingly gets in as the fifth. So, yeah, and I just looked up. Actually, Poor Things is adapted. So it's the Holdovers is favored.
Oh, right, because it's Frankenstein. That makes sense.
Against Past Lives. Those are the two favorites right now.
Oh.
Barbie is at number three. Oh. And if Barbie wins Best Original Screenplay over the Holdovers.
No,
I'm going to be very angry. I can see it happening, but the Barbie script is not that good. Come on, give me a break.
It can't win either. Past Lives and The Holdovers are the best two movies I've seen this year.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't seen Past Lives yet, but I'm ready to.
Yeah.
What else do you want to say about this movie before we move on?
I mean, we haven't really talked about Paul Giamatti at all.
Yeah. Paul Giamatti is always so good. And what's pretty incredible about Paul Giamatti, and I want to make sure I have this right. Paul Giamatti has been nominated for one Oscar. That's it. Don't even know what movie it's from. Don't look it up. What movie is it from?
I'm not sure.
Exactly.
What is it from?
Cinderella Man.
I've never seen that movie. I didn't realize he was in that movie.
Yeah. He was nominated for that, and he lost to George Clooney for Syriana. And Paul Giamatti should have won. Paul Giamatti was the guy that year. It was Jake Gyllenhaal, George Clooney, Matt Dillon for Crash, William Hurt for History of Violence. But Paul Giamatti is phenomenal. He's the, you know, the trainer, whatever. He's great. That's the only time he's been nominated. All these, like, great movies that he's been in. Sideways. Barney's Version was a really good movie. I know not too many people saw that. You know, he's in 12 Years a Slave. He doesn't have a huge role in that. American Splendor is a good one.
And we talked about The Illusionist a couple times.
Illusionist. We brought that up a lot. And the only movie he's ever been nominated for is Cinderella Man back in 2006.
I mean, you guys expect he's getting the nomination this year though, right?
I would assume, when you look at lead actor this year, you're looking at, obviously, Cillian Murphy, he's at the top of the list. Bradley Cooper, Leonardo DiCaprio, Giamatti, and then Coleman Domingo for Rustin right now is who has the fifth best odds on Gold Derby, for what it's worth. I mean, Gold Derby's not always right. Jeffrey Wright, number six for American Fiction, which I don't know if you saw the trailer for that. That looks very good.
No, I haven't.
That looks very good. I'm excited for American Fiction. I think that'll be a good movie. So.
That's how I felt just like watching the trailers before this movie, is I felt like excited about film right now.
Yeah.
And just what's to come.
Coming out. It's about time.
It is about time.
But yeah, I think Giamatti was phenomenal. He's always so good. I'm a huge Giamatti fan. when he picked up the football and threw it, that is the most Alexander Payne moment. He loves doing stuff like that of people just sucking at something so basic. So I love that. But
the scene in Boston when he meets his old, like his old friend or colleague from Harvard, it's so incredible. It's just like sums up the character so well watching him do this. And then like his explanation to Tully afterwards about every, like what his true story is. And the fact that had this been a few days later, Tully would have told everyone.
Yep. Yep. Right? And instead, like, now he's lying and Tully's going along with it. It's fantastic.
Yeah. It's just there. It's so good. And it shows so much growth. And that's what really brings this movie together is, first off, like the chemistry between these three leads is immaculate, but it's these individual storylines that are reinforced by their relationships with each other that makes the ending of this film so powerful.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, because all three of them are just so good, and they're all so well-developed. They could have easily just made this about Paul Giamatti and Dominic Sessa, and the fact that they brought in Randolph's character Mary and make her so impactful, because it's she had it and she lost it.
Yeah,
you know, like Paul Giamatti never had it, and this other kid, he's hiding his pain behind sarcasm and all that other stuff, but she had it and she has the raw emotion, and she is showing them both how you're supposed to, you know, how a lot of people are going to handle loss. And what happens when you're just vulnerable with yourself because you can't take it anymore?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, she's a lock, man. She really is. I would go, you know, for anybody who listens to our Survivor podcast, our last guest has to make a terrible wager because he said that he was going to bet on the Arizona Cardinals to win if somebody went home, and that person went home. But I would go and bet on Devine Joy Randolph winning the Oscar, like, today. I think it's a lock. I think it's a lock. I don't know what the odds would be. They're probably not going to be great, but I think she's a lock.
Her performance is just so good. And again, it is that subtlety thing, right? Like, it's a character that could have been a caricature.
Yeah.
And like, in a lot of movies, this character would be a caricature, and it's not. It's just a full-blown character that is so well-developed and performs immaculately.
Yeah. All right, let's jump over to Spider-Man Homecoming. So, because we're going to be talking about holdovers again. You know, we've mentioned before that in January, February, whenever they announce the Oscars, probably February, we will do a Best Picture Oscar breakdown over on the Patreon, where each episode will get their own, or each movie will get its own episode of the Best Picture nominees. That'll be for our second tier patrons. All the tiers are changing. But if you're into movies, John and I are going to be doing weekly Patreon content for our lowest tier patrons beginning in January. And then that Oscar thing will be for the next tier up. It's only going to be a month. So, you know, I think it's $10. And it's $10. So it'd be $10 pretty much for 1 month of all of that content. But that's neither here nor there. We'll be talking about the holdovers when we get there. Right now, we're going to talk about Spider-Man Homecoming. First Spider-Man movie in this series, which takes place after the events of Civil War, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the beginning of this movie is Civil War.
It is Civil War. Okay, I knew it was like after, but I wanted to make sure I was saying we can say it takes place after, even if parts of it are that. I really like Tom Holland.
Yeah.
This movie just wanted to have 9,000 storylines, and it didn't need to, and I don't know why they chose to.
They really wanted to lead into this like mentorship role of Tony Stark and this like father son, like surrogate son relationship. And in previous viewings of this movie, I enjoy this one. Like I give it 2.5. It's on the top half of the Marvel movies that we've watched for sure. But this time watching it, it's just like this storyline with Tony Stark is like not really present, but is there still. There's the weird, like, hot Aunt May stuff that's going on because Marisa Tomei's playing her.
Thrown in. I don't get it.
It is. It's just a little too much. And then you have like the whole like Vulture side of it all, like whatever, there's going to be a supervillain. Like that makes sense. But like this movie's best when it's being like the John Hughes high school movie. And I don't even like John Hughes high school movies.
Yeah. I don't like John Hughes high school movies at all. I talk about that all the time. So Jason Obermeyer says, have you guys seen the other two iterations of Spider-Man? If so, thoughts how they stand with this MCU universe or version? I never saw the Andrew Garfield ones. I loved the first two Tobey Maguire ones. The third one is atrocious. That is a horrible, horrible movie. I don't care what anybody says.
Yeah, but it's so good because it's so bad.
No, it's atrocious. I hate that movie so much. I really like the first two. I never saw The Amazing Spider-Man. I like this one, but it doesn't hold a candle, I don't think, to the originals. And I think what makes the originals so good, especially the first Spider-Man, like talking the first one with the Green Goblin and Uncle Ben and Aunt May and all that stuff, it felt new, it felt fresh, it felt unique. It all felt very original because we hadn't seen superhero movies done that way. You know, we'd seen the darkness of the Tim Burton Batman movies, but this was a brighter, you know, fun movie. It has J.K. Simmons as J. Jonah Jameson, which is the greatest casting choice ever, like maybe in any movie ever. It's ridiculous. He popped off of the comic book and became J. Jonah Jameson. I don't know how J.K. Simmons did that, but it got more into that stuff. It got more into the pizza delivery boy and getting bit by the spider. And I don't need to get a whole retelling of him getting bit by the spider. I know the story. I get it. We've done it. But also, by dropping us into the middle of it, you're asking me to care a lot about tertiary characters that I don't care about and I'm not going to care about. And I feel like there was no character development to 90% of the characters in this movie, which is what made the original Spider-Man movie so strong. That Sam Raimi Spider-Man movie is so strong because when things happen, they mean something. And this one, I was kind of like, well, that would be kind of cool. I wonder what would happen if they fell all the way down the elevator shaft at the Washington Monument. That wouldn't be so bad, huh? Like, no part of me. Yeah, no, I'm joking. No part of me, though, cared about any of the characters that were standing on that elevator shaft. I didn't care. So I think that's what's hard about it. And it tried to, you know, it went with the team and going to academic decathlon and doing all that stuff. I just don't think that that's the most fun way you could have done this. And I feel like with how fun Tom Holland is, because he plays it with the boyish sense of, oh my God, I'm an Avenger, or am I an Avenger, or whatever it is. I think you miss some opportunities by making it this kind of Breakfast Club situation. I mean, there's one of the most popular posters on Letterboxd is of the Breakfast Club, but it's them. Yep. It's these characters. The problem is I don't connect to any of the other characters. Zendaya's great. I mean, she's fun. She's really fun in the movie doing her like,
she's like in like, she has like four lines in this movie
and they all hit, they all land.
They do. Yeah.
The other three, I don't care about, you know, his love interest. I don't care about Lobby Boy. I don't care about. And what is it? Who's even the other person? Like the teacher, I don't care. You know, it's very whatever. And I think that's the problem. When it focuses on Tom Holland, it's really good. Forcing the mentorship from Tony Stark does feel forced. I agree with you.
Yeah.
It's still okay, but it feels forced. And then the Aunt May stuff is so just there to be there, but there's no development of Aunt May. And there's no development of any of his character, like his little buddies in high school. So that's where this movie really takes a bit of a beating for me, or it's just missing some areas.
I think one of the things that bugs me about this, and now that we've opened up the can of worms that is the Raimi Spider-Man, and like we're gonna dive into just Spider-Man in general here. I think the Tony Stark mentorship kind of takes away from the Spider-Man of it all, because. Yeah. Spider-Man is this homegrown hero, right? And it's also why I think like going to DC was a bad decision in this movie. Spider-Man has to stay in New York because the whole point of this is Peter's supposed to figure out, he wants, like, we get the conclusion of the movie, right? I just want to be a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think taking him out of New York really kind of ruins that. And it's kind of just like my view of like the MCU Spider-Man in general is that if he feels too much like an Avenger and not enough like Spider-Man. And we have this, like, Tom Holland plays Peter Parker fantastic. He's got like the awkwardness down, but he still has those like quips that you're used to from Spider-Man and stuff when he's fighting. And he's like handsome enough, but not too handsome that it really fits the role. And he's like awkward and gangly and all of this, right? But we're not seeing that translate to him as Spider-Man at all. We don't see him struggling as Spider-Man. We don't see him learning how to be Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest problem with the movie. And that's what I'm talking about. So we don't, while we're not seeing him learn how to be Spider-Man, because we already saw Civil War where he is full blown Spider-Man. He's ready to go. And now he's got the suit and he's learning how to use the suit and he's already hunting down bad guys and he's trying to save the community, all of that. There's so many missed opportunities for the fun growth stuff. You know, his sidekick chair guy is pretty good. I mean, you know, that's pretty good because he's, you know, excited that he's going to be, he knows Spider-Man and all that, but I don't care about him going to the party and he's going to become Spider-Man to prove these kids wrong and all that stuff. That's just not that fun. It's just not that interesting. And I think that Michael Keaton and the bad guys are fun enough in this movie, but Vulture, I guess his name is. I do love that they never say the names of what the characters are. They just assume you'll know. I had no idea. Is this Clockwork from Sly Cooper? Is that what
they call him? Like Vulture guy? I'm trying to recall. I don't think you ever hear his actual name of Adrian Toomes ever.
I think you just hear Toomes. You just have to
assume. I think you hear Mr. Toomes at the very beginning of the movie.
Yeah. 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 So I don't know. All that being said, fun movie, but I do agree with you. It feels more like an Avengers movie than a Spider-Man movie. And I guess that's the point in the MCU that we're at 16 movies in, is everything starting to feel like the Avengers. He doesn't like the Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, which I really enjoyed. And I know you hate that felt like a different movie.
Yes.
That I'll felt that. Like something different from what every other character, every other hero is doing in their movies. What Spider-Man was doing in this movie felt like it was just a way to get him involved more with the Avengers. That's all it felt like. Yeah. It just felt like it was, oh, he's an Avenger. He's an Avenger. Don't forget, he's an Avenger. Or he's going to become something, even if he's not officially an Avenger. He's doing this. It felt like he just was going to attack bad guys. And that was really all that was going to happen. He was going to attack the bad guys because he wanted to be the bad guy guy. There was nothing else going on. I don't know. It felt like if they would have just focused, and I keep saying I feel like because I'm trying to think of what would have actually made this better. But I think all they had to do to make it better was focus on what the first Spider-Man focused on, which was the friendships and how those impact him being Spider-Man. And I know I said that at the party, it didn't feel all that interesting, but that was because it felt so side story to everything else that was going on. I didn't know where to focus. I didn't know what Peter Parker's real struggle in this movie was, aside from his boredom that Tony Stark won't call him. That seemed like his biggest struggle. Everything else felt like it was forced, and I would have liked to seen everything else developed more because it should have been more interesting than it was.
Because like they set this movie up in a way where the character development should be there with Peter, like, again, like the Spider-Man conflict in the bank leading to Peter seeing the explosion, chasing the bad guys and everything and getting his ass whooped by Vulture.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's a moment. And then he tries to like do it again. The problem is like Peter needs Tony to like take away the suit. I think the problem is just this like superpowered suit. Is what it comes down to. Because
I was confused whether or not he was able to do anything on his own or if it was all the suit. And then when he took the suit off and he's doing flips and stuff, I was reminded that, oh yeah, he did get bit by a radioactive spider. So that's why he is better. But I do agree. The suit feels a little forced because the suit was just meant to be why he was able to still move around so easily. Right. Isn't that what it is?
Well, it gives him like different web shooters and stuff. And like,
yeah,
lets him like have like the reconnaissance mode and stuff like that, and kill mode, whatever that joke was.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. I'm saying in the but the original Spider-Man suit is just meant to be
conceal his identity.
It yeah, is to that's conceal all it his is. Identity. It's not meant to have so much going on,
and that's the thing. Is like part of Spider-Man's character is always this idea of concealing his identity to protect the ones he loves, mm-hmm. and that's never really addressed in this. We get the like awkward moment where Vulture, like where Adrian Toomes realizes that Peter Parker is Spider-Man, but it's like it's really quick. It's like as soon as he meets him. And granted, based on the conversation with what Liz was saying in the car, very easy to figure out he's Spider-Man at that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you should probably figure this out yourself. But like, of course, Liz doesn't know that like Spider-Man left from the party and like did all that, right? So she's missing some of the details, but it's pretty obvious Peter Spider-Man, just based on everything that happened.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. It's very funny. You know, the drama, the dramatic irony there is a little forced. I like the Michael Keaton slowly figuring out what's going on, and I like that immediately Peter Parker knows, and Vulture is slowly figuring it out, and then when he finally does figure it out, he has the nice excuse of, just go in there and we'll forget this ever happened. I'm giving you another chance, because he doesn't want to kill a kid, right? I do feel like, though, this makes sense, because why would he want to kill a high school kid? He just never thought Spider-Man was actually Spider-Boy.
Yeah, it didn't prevent him from taking a gun out in the car.
Well, just in case he mouths
off. Just in case he's Spider-Man's you, I guess.
Yeah, you gotta be ready to just shoot him in the head. But yeah, no, I agree. It was funny that he pulled the gun out but never actually aimed the gun at Spider-Man. He just kind of put it in front of the...
Just put it there. It's the intimidation tactic. Yeah. Don't even think about it there, Spider-Boy.
But do you know where to point it? Because if you don't know where to point it, then I'm going to be good. You know?
He's a child. He assumes the adult knows how to use a gun.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But yeah, I do like Michael Keaton. At one point, I thought that was Tom Hardy in this movie.
Oh. Nope.
Because he's like bald and has a beard, and I thought it was funny. Maybe they were making a joke of like, hey, he's Venom, but also he's right here, because Venom obviously was a disaster. But
that came out after this movie.
Oh, okay. See, I didn't realize. I didn't know if like maybe he was in this and then that turned them into...
No.
Nah. Okay. Well, I'm stupid then. My fault. Okay. But that for a second, I thought it was him, and I thought it was a weird choice. I was like, damn, was he not that big that he gets that small of a role here? I like Shocker. I like that it was Bokeem Woodbine. Yeah. He never gets – he's not in enough stuff. Bokeem Woodbine in season 2 of Fargo.
So good.
Oh, my God. That is one of the great TV acting performances ever. He is so freaking good in season 2 of Fargo. He's terrifying, man. I loved him in that. So it was cool to see him in this movie. Mm-hmm. But – you know, even Shocker, it felt like, I'm Shocker.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, be more of Shocker. Be more of comic book Shocker. This, I always talk about these when we do these movies, John.
Yeah.
This didn't feel like comic booky to me. It didn't feel
comic-booky. It had element. It felt like again, a video like, game. It goes too far into the John Hughes of it all. So much so that there is a sight gag in this movie of Spider-Man running through backyards. And they felt the need to show us a clip from Ferris Bueller's Day Off so that we got the joke. And I was like, man, you know, this joke would be like way better if you didn't do this.
If you didn't explain it. Yeah.
Because I had forgotten that bit was there when I was rewatching it. And as I'm watching him go through the backyards and stuff, I'm like, oh, it's Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And then it cuts to Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I'm like, joke's ruined now.
Yep. Yeah. I know. And then I thought there were going to be repercussions because he was destroying everything in the people's yards. And instead they just never addressed it. I thought that was part of like the reason why they were showing us him breaking everything, because look, Spider-Man, you don't understand. You can't just go around breaking things. Yeah, but I was chasing the bad guy. Yeah, but now the Tony Stark has to take out a checkbook for $1 billion to pay for everything. But instead they just never address it. And Spider-Man just completely decimates this entire neighborhood.
Honestly, what you're missing is a J. Jonah Jameson in this movie.
You are.
I don't think people realize how pivotal that character is to Spider-Man. His insistence that Spider-Man is a menace and like that dramatic irony that we as consumers of this whatever medium it's being shown in know that JJ is wrong is necessary, but it adds that bit of like Peter Parker has to be careful about what he's doing.
Agreed.
Because he's being scrutinized so publicly.
Yeah, whereas in this movie, it doesn't feel like it was almost hard for me to understand why Spider-Man wasn't getting bad publicity. I couldn't understand it. When the initial bank convenience store scene happens, I was anticipating bad news for Spider-Man. We never really got it. And no. I think that's a big mistake on the MCU producers' part. I think not going to the more popular parts of Spider-Man. I understand wanting to make it its own. Mm-hmm. But even if you're not going to make him a newspaper boy and you don't want to have J. Jonah Jameson be that, have the teacher be that then. Have the teacher be the guy who's constantly saying, this Spider-Man's ridiculous, blah, blah, blah. And then he gets saved in the elevator and he's still like, I still don't like Spider-Man. This is a very easy solution. You can have that be a J. Jonah Jameson type character where he's over the top and always talking about it, whatever. Instead, that teacher character is horrible. It's just a total throwaway. And so, yeah, you're right. The J. Jonah Jameson character is way more important than they understood here.
Yeah. Also, I think now that you've mentioned like the whole bodega exploding and everything, why doesn't Peter have any emotional response to that?
It seems like he does, and then he saves the guy, and then that's the end of that.
Yeah, like, why doesn't that weigh on him, right? Like, this is another thing that kind of bugs me about this characterization of Spider-Man. He doesn't feel responsible.
Yeah.
And if Spider-Man should feel anything, it's responsibility.
Yeah. No, that's true. That is definitely true. And Tony Stark hints at that at one point where he says, if somebody had died, then guess
what? That's on you.
That's on you.
And then, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So, and you know, then he never actually is the reason anybody dies. So, yep. I don't know. I really don't. I really don't know what they could have done, because also, do you want to have 14/15-year-old Peter Parker be so guilty about everything? Probably not. And that's the problem with the MCU dealing with a teenage character and being a lighter version of what the Dark Knight and the DC movies were doing, which is they were dark. They're very dark. And this movie, this whole franchise is trying to be lighter and for everyone. Mm-hmm. And this felt like it was trying to be for everyone.
But if that's the case, like, they should have put more emphasis on the fact that Peter's a teenager.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we kind of get it because of the mentorship role and everything, where it's like, you know, people don't take him seriously because he's a kid and stuff. But what we should have been getting is, hey, I'm a kid in high school, but there's a crime going on that I need to go fight. Right? Like,
yeah.
Nothing seemed to disrupt him at all. Every time we see him as Spider-Man in this, it's always at night. And everything only happens at night when he's not in school.
Yeah.
There's no disruption happening. And because of that,
for when he goes to the decathlon. That happens during the day.
Sure. But that was also his own doing.
Yeah, that's true.
Because they had alien technology in the bag that is exposed to radiation. Probably don't do that. Maybe don't take strange things around with you and like hide them in the hotel room or something.
Yeah.
Or just don't take them across state lines. That might help too.
Yeah.
I want to circle around to Vulture though, because Vulture, I think, Vulture is one of the first villains in the MCU that has like this problem that the MCU takes. And that is, he's not the worst when it comes to it. He's not the best example of it. And we're going to get to some that are better. The MCU is now at a point, 16 movies in, where our villain doesn't feel all that villainous.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I felt like at the end of the movie when he chooses not to kill him, I said, good, I'm glad he didn't. And then when they put him in jail and he's all, you know, oh, if I knew who he was, he'd already be dead. I'm like, that's great. But I really didn't hate this guy. Kind of wish that him and Spider-Man would have just learned to work together to do something.
Well, and if we look at even like his motivations, right? His motivations are, hey, Tony Stark totally screwed over my offer, like my job opportunities and everything. So I had to make ends meet. Like it's this idea of the wealthy elite exploiting and manipulating the working class. And we're supposed to be like, find that villainous here,
Yeah.
is the way it's presented to us. It's like, no, this guy's kind of sticking up for like the every man here. And like, is he doing it the best way possible? No. And like, we aren't at the point where the villain does a heinous act to make you hate them because you agree with them too much. Like, the Vulture's not dropping babies out of the sky or anything like that, right? But they kind of just like make him a bad guy because he wants to hurt Peter. And that's it, right? Like, but the problem is, it's like we can have complicated villains. We should have. I really think these MCU movies would really elevate themselves if they had a villain that I completely agree with and they don't do something heinous. And then I have to like actually think about the actions that the heroes are taking against them.
Yeah,
Like
that's
something to
not gonna
watch.
happen.
It's something to watch for moving forward is you'll watch these, you'll see these villains, they'll make compelling arguments for why they're doing what they're doing, and they will do a single heinous act, and that's the reason why they're bad guys.
Yeah, I'm curious what the case is gonna be in a movie like The Marvels when we get to that 7,000 years from now. Because that movie is being pretty much panned, and then
I watched
obviously,
it. I saw
did
it
you?
last
Oh,
night.
you did.
Yeah,
Did you like it?
I didn't hate it.
That
It was
disturbs me.
enjoyable.
That disturbs me deeply, Jonathan.
Well, it's not my name, so that's fine.
I know it disturbs. I was talking to my buddy here
Course.
because it disturbs me that much. Okay. Yeah, it did terrible box office wise though. Holy crap. Like
It
really
sure
bad.
did. I was in a near
Really bad.
empty theater last night.
Yeah, like really bad. I know a lot of people are gonna, it'll be spun by Disney when it finally comes up that they'll say, "Oh no, worldwide we made
No, they
$220 million."
didn't make any money worldwide either. It was
No, but
bad.
I'm saying like when they add them both together, it's probably gonna make
Oh, of course.
$220 million, which is what the budget was. But man, that does not count P&A. It's gonna be kind of like the Little Mermaid situation where they're gonna try to pretend that everything is great when everything is not great right now. This is a disaster. This is really bad. The budget plus P&A is almost $350 million, and domestically it hasn't even hit 50 million yet, which is
It
crazy because
was.
we're talking about Spider-Man, which what the net is it the next Spider-Man that's the highest grossing Marvel, or was the highest grossing Marvel, or was it the
No, I think Infinity War is still the highest grossing Marvel movie.
What did Spider-Man, what was the one Spider-Man? Did it get
The
to
original Spider-Man, like from 2002, was the highest grossing movie for a long time.
No, but didn't Far From Home make like over $1 billion? Yeah, it did. It made over $1 billion worldwide.
Far From Home? Or
Yeah.
no way. Wait, which ones? I can't even remember which ones. The names for these Spider-Man movies are too confusing. I don't know
Are they
which one's which
ridiculous? Yeah,
anymore.
because I'm looking up Spider-Man Far From Home and it made 1 point whatever billion dollars, and it is the fourth highest rated opening behind Maverick, Jurassic World Dominion, Endgame.
Yeah, so Endgame has the highest.
That was
And
just the opening.
No Way Home was the following one, I'm pretty sure.
Okay, got it, got it, got it,
So
got it,
that's
got
the
it.
third one, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. Yeah. Cause I just remember Far From Home did like ridiculous box office. It's just funny to talk about that the same week that the worst box office is happening
It
for.
is actually the worst MCU box office opening
It
ever.
is. Yeah, it is. Officially. And it's
But
going to be by a significant margin when all is said and
it's
done.
not. It's not the worst MCU movie I've seen by a long shot.
Yeah. I mean, I believe that there's some bad ones that we've watched so far. So I believe that.
No, there's some bad ones coming up too.
I can't wait. Anyway, what are we doing next week, John?
Well, is your favorite MCU movie next week? It
Is it
is
really? Have
Black
we finally
Panther.
hit that moment?
We've hit Black Panther, but it's the halfway point.
That's too. That doesn't matter, dude. That doesn't matter.
It's the halfway point. Once we get through where...
No, we're not. Next week is Thor Ragnarok.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, thank God I looked. I knew there was one more before Black Panther. It's Thor Ragnarok.
Oh, well, that's much better. We got to watch Taika Waititi do stuff.
Okay, cool. So, and we're not going to do Next Goal Wins, even though it would be a nice pairing, huh?
It would be a nice pairing, but the plan is the killer, right?
You know, John, I'm thinking I might change my mind.
Okay.
And what I want to see what you think.
Okay.
Thanksgiving.
Let me see. It's not Thanksgiving here, so I have to make sure it's actually playing here.
Oh, it's not Thanksgiving here yet either, but they're putting it out. I just checked my
theater. I know, but Thanksgiving was a month ago here.
The reviews are phenomenal. It's a slasher.
It is.
I don't want to watch
the new Hunger Games. I'm in.
Yeah, I don't want to watch the new Hunger Games. And I feel like The Killer is a good movie that we can have maybe like beginning of January when nothing's coming out. And we say we just need another movie. We haven't done this Fincher movie yet. Let's jump in and do that. And maybe by that point, more people will have seen it. But right now, let's take advantage of this. Yeah, we have a lot of box office movies coming out this week. And I can't sit here and do... I think Next Goal Wins is going to get smoked. I can't do the Hunger Games. I don't want to do Trolls Band Together. I haven't even seen the other ones. So I think Thanksgiving's the move, man. I think that'll be a fun Eli Roth, ridiculous movie.
Oh, it's Eli Roth. That's right.
Yeah.
This is going to be a gory movie. Everyone beware. Like, we're warning you right now. We don't even have to see the movie. This is going to be a gory movie.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be brutal. So I'm excited, though. So let's do that. Jason Obermeier asks, Phil, now we're halfway through the MCU. How are you holding up? It's starting to feel a little bit like a chore. Today, I watched Spider-Man Homecoming today, and it did feel a little bit like, when am I going to fit that movie in? I really don't feel like watching it all week. So it is starting to feel a little bit more like a chore, especially since I know that the one's coming up shortly. I just know I'm not going to like, I know Black Panther. I hate, I already saw it. Ant-Man and the Wasp, like whatever. Captain Marvel, I'm sure I'm not going to be too much of a fan of. The Avengers movies, I always feel like aren't that good. Even if people say Infinity War and Endgame are good.
Well, these are directed by the Russo brothers. We're done with Joss Whedon in the Avengers. We're back to the Russo brothers.
I don't care. It feels like a little bit like a chore. It does. It really does. So that's how I feel about that. Halfway there. I'm going to end this because I want to go to bed. So I will see everybody later. Thank you all for listening. We will be back next Wednesday night. And make sure to check out our Patreon, because starting in January, a lot more movie content going over there on the Patreon. So it'll be worth your while. And especially if you're a Survivor fan too, it's a double dip. So talk to you all later.